This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Türkiye is a golfer's paradise, and much of that is down to Belek on the country's southern Mediterranean coast. Courses here cut through lush pine forest, set on fast, sandy ground that's kept in immaculate condition all year round. And for those never quite ready to call it a day, Belek is also host to the first full 18-hole floodlit course in Europe. Local pro Dennis Sutmaz is lucky enough to call Belek her training ground.
There are more than 15 courses. You can play golf in winter and summer.
And once the round is done, long lunches replace scorecards and spas, hammams and slow afternoons take over.
When I'm not playing golf, I usually go to the beach, tan, go into the sea. You just feel like you're in another world.
Because in Belek, luxury isn't about excess. It's about time well spent. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
In last week's elections for the European Parliament, the voters of France delivered a major rebuff to the party of the president, Emmanuel Macron, with twice as many voting for the nationalist Rassemblement National, National Rally, of his rival Marine Le Pen. Immediately the vote was announced, Macron shocked everyone by calling a snap parliamentary election. The first round of voting will happen before the end of the month. The result could be deeply consequential for the EU, for Ukraine and for us here in Britain. So why did Macron call this election? And what happens if he loses and France gets a Le Pen government? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what just happened to who and what's going to happen next? Joining me in the briefing room are Hugh Schofield, the BBC's Paris correspondent, and Sophie Pedder, Paris bureau chief at The Economist. Hugh Schofield, can you run us through what happened in France's European election results? Who got what?
Well, it was quite straightforward and very much in line with predictions of the polls. Basically, the National Rally, that's Jordan Bardella and Marine Le Pen's party, the hard right, got 31.5%. So a massive turnout for it, nearly a third of voters, and well ahead of the next list, which was President Macron's list under a woman called Valérie Ayer, which got around 15%, so not even half of what the hard right got. And indeed, another hard right party, the one that sort of, in a way, is a kind of split-off of the National Rally, a more ideological one called Reconquest, Reconquête, which got just over 5%, so enough to return, you know, a handful of MEPs. And it meant that, you know, if you added the 31.5 to the 5 or so for the Reconquête party, you have a hard right vote there of, you know, 37-38%. And that's what, of course, just took everyone totally by surprise.
Now, Sophie Pedder, is this seen as a verdict on Macron's party or on Macron himself?
Well, I mean, the thing about the French system is that the president really is so dominant. He has such sort of centralized powers that whatever he does, he always takes the blame for things when things go wrong. And therefore, it is inevitably a verdict on him. And Jordan Bardella, who is Marine Le Pen's candidate in this campaign, he made it very clear and explicit. He said, this is a chance to sanction Macron. This is a chance to, in effect, have a sort of midterm vote against him. So I think it is about him. He has a style which irritates a lot of people. And he, you know, because of the system, he embodies the power of the moment. So it's more about him, I think, than it is about Renaissance as a party.
Hugh, Sophie just mentioned there, this character, Jordan Bardella. It's not necessarily easy for us to understand. Is it right that Marine Le Pen
is the kind of big cheese in her party, and she stood for the presidency, but someone else gets nominated by the party to be their prime ministerial candidate. And in this instance, it's Bardella.
Well, we don't know that, but we think that, and they certainly haven't denied that. And there is a slight confusion in the roles, because technically, Jordan Bardella, I think I'm right in saying, is the president of the party. But everyone knows that the real power is Marine Le Pen, and she made sure that he got that job. It's still very much a Le Pen affair, the National Rally. But when it comes to this question of the jobs, as I understand it, the thinking would be that, yes, if everything goes well for the National Rally at the elections which are approaching, and let us say they are able to form a government, then he would be the prime minister. And the understanding behind that would be that 3 years from now, in 2027, when there is a presidential election, it would be the more senior character, the one with the more presidential status, that is Marine Le Pen, who would run as president. Now, I mean, I think the obvious point that has to be made is the kind of, what, a 28-year-old as prime minister? That is a factor in all of this. You know, he's a remarkable character in many ways, no doubt, and very presentable and very gifted, but he has absolutely no experience. I think the calculation on Macron's part is that people at the election we're about to have will say, no, we can't do that. We can vote against him at the Europeans and enjoy doing it. But at such a crucial thing as this, we need to come back to the centre ground. That's his gamble. But of course, no one knows whether it's going to pay off.
I want to come on to Sophie's assessment of the same question in a moment. But Sophie, first, can you remind British listeners who the National Rally are and where they came from?
Well, in answer to the first question, they are, of course, the descendants of Jean-Marie Le Pen's National Front, which he founded way back and in the 1950s and has taken on various incarnations since then. It used to be very much a sort of anti-Semitic, xenophobic protest party filled with people nostalgic for French Algeria, a lot of military sort of supporters. And it was a party that had its base originally in the south of France, a lot of the Pieds Noirs, the French settlers in Algeria, who came back after Algerian independence. Now, today, Marine Le Pen has been on a campaign to sort of sanitise the party, clean it up, try and purge it, get rid of all of most unpalatable elements. And when you see her deputies today, if you see them in the National Assembly, I mean, they sit there in suits and ties. They're all sort of clean shaven and they behave better than the guys on the far left. So this is all part of a strategy for her to prepare her party for power and to try to demonstrate that it is not the party of her father and that it is a party that people can shouldn't be, that's in her view, ashamed of saying they vote for.
Hugh, can you remind us what the situation currently is in the French Parliament, the balance between the parties?
Macron's party, Renaissance, is the biggest party. We had an election for the president back in 2022, and he won, of course. And then in the immediate aftermath of that, we had the parliamentary election, which is sort of standard practice. And it's always presumed, it was always sort of just part of the way France was run, to expect that in that parliamentary election, a majority would automatically follow for the president who just got in. So that people would say to the president, right, we've given you the job, and now here are the tools, here are the lawmakers for you. It didn't work out that way. And this is the origin of the whole problem, really. It didn't work out that way. The country felt very ambivalent towards Macron, it turned out. They were prepared to see him in power again because they didn't want Marine Le Pen. But having done that, they said, well, hang on a sec, we don't like you that much, so we won't give you the tools to do the job. And as a result, he got the most seats in Parliament, but he can be outvoted by the combination of everyone else. He does not have this majority, and when, as can happen, you know, everyone else gangs up against him, he can't get anything through. And at the same time, we have this big, big load of seats, 80 or so for the hard right, which was a massive breakthrough. They were really the ones that were crying victory on election night in 2022 after the legislatives, because they'd never had this amount of seats before, ever. And that was, in a way, the real breakthrough of that night. And then you have, you know, a big good lot on the left and on the far left, which did very well as well, and a kind of rump of the old parties, the socialists and the old Gaullists. And so this is the root of it all, his inability to do anything in Parliament. And he's a man who's constantly on about all the reforms he wants to do and how his vision for France is this and that, but he can't do anything. So his idea was, well, let's cut the Gordian knot and start afresh with a new Parliament. But, you know, as we keep saying, it is an almighty gamble.
Sophie, do you agree with that? I mean, because it does seem very odd that just after you have lost an election very badly, you then go back and seek an even more important election under those circumstances. What's your explanation?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, I think Macron thinks he can win. I've just been at his press conference in Paris and he is absolutely unbowed. I mean, he doesn't look like a man who thinks he's about to lose an election. You might call that delusional or you might call that optimistic, but I think that he's not calling this election in order to lose this election. Having said that, you know, it's going to be incredibly difficult for him, but it was always going to be. And I think the point about the timing is key to this. You know, in September, as you said, there is a budget that has to be passed. It's the opportunity for the opposition parties to all sort of gang up against him, should they have chosen to do so, and vote it down, which would have forced him to use an article in the Constitution which goes through, makes the legislation go through without a vote. And that gets up people's backs. And it also exposes the government to a confidence vote, which can then topple the government anyway and lead to fresh elections. So all that to say that he was already sort of up against this scenario for September. And Macron hates being backed into a corner on anything. And I think what he's done is try at least to control the timing and call the snap election in the hope that it will, I mean, the word he uses is clarification. He wants there to be a clarification among electors. Do they actually really want the national rally to be in power? Or is it just a protest vote? And when you actually put it in front of the policy, the manifesto, the, you know, what are their fiscal plans? What is, are their plans on education, on energy, whatever? Where, do people really want to have them run their country? And that is, I think, that sort of clarification is what's behind why he wants to hold this vote now, after having already just had that European election.
Hugh, when's the vote going to take place? And explain the two-stage process to us and what difference it makes.
So it'll take place over 2 weeks, a week apart, or Sundays as always in France. So that's June the 30th, July the 7th, with the British election bang in the middle. And in the first round, and this is the, you know, the big theory, the first round is where there are loads of lists and everyone can vote for the one that's really, really close to their views, their interests, and, you know, the one they really identify with. And there's a panoply of choice and you go for, you know, and some lists come up with just get 2% or 3%. But the hope is, and the original plan was when they devised this, was that there'd be, broadly speaking, at the end of the day, one list that did very well on the left and one list that did very well on the right, and it would be very obvious. And then in the second round, which would be a week later or 2 weeks later in the case of presidentials, people would rally round one or other of those two. And the runoff is between the two who come up first in the first round. And that's the principle. And it worked as long as politics was existing in its sort of conventional post-war way with, you know, a sort of Christian Democrat-y, Gaullist-y right and a socialist-y, social democrat-y left, and then all the fringes around it. And then you know, the big guy on the left and the big guy on the right would go through, and everyone would rally round, and it would be a broadly a left-right ding-dong. But that's all gone. I mean, that's all completely gone. And that's why everything is very unpredictable.
Let's go a little bit more now into how French politics actually works. In other words, what the kind of constitutional disposition of powers is. Sophie, if Macron loses these upcoming parliamentary elections, what happens to him?
Well, nothing happens to him. He remains president of France. The French constitution for the Fifth Republic is very clear about that. These are parliamentary elections. They're not presidential elections. But what changes is the prospect of him, if the national rally comes top, which is not at all, you know, impossible. He has to govern with a government that is not just his an opposition party, but it's the party that most of the kind of moderate parties of France have done their best to keep out of power for the last forever, but certainly under the Fifth Republic. So it is that prospect that is just, it means France is going to be in untested waters. We've had periods of cohabitation in France before, of course. We've had three, in fact, and the most recent is, it carries a bit of a sort of salutary lesson, because in 1997, when Jacques Chirac, the Gaullist president, was in charge, he decided to call snap elections under very similar circumstances, except that he had a majority at the time, and the objective then was to shore up his majority. And he ended up with a result that put the socialists in power. And so he then had to govern with the socialists for 5 years under Lionel Jospin. And that was a complicated period of cohabitation. Now, those at least were sort of parties that shared basic central sort of values in France. They may have had quite different ideologies. But the prospect for Macron, a centrist, having to govern as president, with a government under, it would be Bardella, I think. I would just add to what Hugh said earlier, Marine Le Pen has said she will name Bardella as prime minister or put his name forward. The prospect of Macron doing that just is it's unprecedented. It's extremely difficult to see how that could be anything other than continually conflictual both and in parliament as well, because the opposition parties would be up in arms about every single piece of legislation that came through parliament.
Sophie, what powers would Macron keep which are relatively untrammelled by Parliament?
In theory, the French constitution under the Fifth Republic gives the president powers over foreign policy and defence and security policy. So, for example, he keeps his finger firmly on the nuclear button. He will be the one who represents France at NATO summits. He continues to go to all the European summits. He is in charge. But you have to sort of remember that there are subjects that blur that. So the domestic politics, which is supposed to be the government's prerogative, take as an example, aid to Ukraine. Ultimately, those sort of gestures require budgets, and those budgets have to be passed by the government and parliament. So therefore, you are going to have these points of tension if this comes about, whereby the president in theory makes those decisions, but that parliament could be obstructive and blocking.
Hugh, has there been any talk of Macron deciding, if he loses the election badly, that the game's not worth the candle and he'll resign?
At the press conference which he gave on Wednesday, he made it quite clear that he is not resigning, and it would be totally out of character for him to do that. I mean, you know, one can imagine a scenario, I suppose, in which he feels that he's made such a mess of it all by allowing in the national rally to power when, let's not forget, and this is constantly being thrown in his face, you know, he's said from the very beginning of his first term that a vote for me is a vote against the extremes, vote for me to keep the extremes out. You know, basically, it's the national rally or me. And if at the end of the day in 2024, he is the man responsible for bringing in the elections that usher in a National Rally hard-right government, then arguably he has failed in the most sort of inexorable and glaring way and might feel under pressure to sort of bow out gracefully. But I don't think that will happen, because he's a man of immense self-belief, immense energy, and he'll say, right now, it's my duty to do what I can to salvage what I can, and he would lead a presidency which would be asserting his rights where they are quite clear on foreign policy and defence and so on, and sniping and doing whatever he can to undermine whoever's prime minister, Bardella.
Hugh, very briefly, just to clarify for listeners, Macron's term ends in 2027, doesn't it? And he can't run again. That's the end of it for him.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Two terms. And so whatever happens in the next few years is also conditioned by that. He's not running again. And so he's also got to sort of face the possibility in the next 3 years of pretenders coming in behind him. I see him in this as trying to remain, what the French say, you know, maître de l'horloge, master of the clock. He desperately wants to be the one who tells people what to do when, and is the kind of great organiser of everything. He hates things happening to him. He wants to be the actor, he's certainly the actor here.
Hugh Schofield and Sophie Pedder. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about the threat that ransomware poses, the one about synthetic opioids claiming lives in the UK, and the one asking whether the UK can meet the net zero challenge.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back to events in France. And now I want to find out a bit more about what a national rally government might look like. Joining me are Mujtaba Rahman, Managing Director for Europe at the Eurasia Group, and Françoise Bocek of the School of Politics and International Relations at Queen Mary University of London. Françoise Bocek, what would a national rally government look like? What would we expect if it formed something like a majority?
Okay, well, just a word of caution. It's difficult to envisage a situation where it would be strong enough to win a majority of seats. I think if it's more feasible that it might win a plurality of seats, the largest share of the seats, in which case it has to make an alliance. For the sake of argument, if they win the largest share of seats and they have found partners to form a majority government, then the question is who becomes prime minister? And Le Pen has said clearly, again yesterday, she said, yes, Bardella would be the prime minister. And presumably then she would, you know, keep her eyes on for the presidency, have another go at it, a third go at the presidency in 2027. But then, you know, if she gets re-elected herself, as she probably will, she will, you know, get a seat in parliament again. Will she be happy to continue driving the legislative agenda as a parliamentary leader of her party in the National Assembly? You know, what would be the relationship between the two of them? You know, it's really difficult to say at this point. I mean, as Mitch said, Bardella is, you know, he's a very astute politician. He's popular among the young. He appeals to them, especially to the underprivileged. He's from Saint-Denis, a very one of the poorest areas of France, in fact. He has a very good presence on TV. But, you know, there could be then frictions between the two of them, because we already saw on Sunday how, you know, he's the one who made the first statement about daring Macron to call an election. And then when he did so, and then when they finally had their victory speech, she was trying to take the limelight away from him. So she was at the mic and he was sort of standing behind her. So you could already feel sort of what the tensions might be in a situation like that.
Mujtaba Rahman, what do you think?
We've seen in the last 24 hours that forming an alliance is going to be very tricky for National Rally. Les Républicains, so the right-wing party, have voted out their leader, Eric Ciotti, because he tried to strike a deal with National Rally. And another far-right party, Reconquest, held talks with National Rally, but they broke down. So it's not going to be easy. In terms of Le Pen delivering a majority, and I don't think that's likely, we have to assign probabilities to these outcomes. We think Le Pen with an absolute majority in parliament is probably a 30% probability, and much more likely is a hung parliament and deadlock and paralysis. But if you were to end up in a situation either where Le Pen and Bardella control a majority in the assembly or came first, I agree with Francoise. I think the implications of that would be quite profound. There have been three previous cohabitations between presidents and governments of different political persuasions from the centre-right and the centre-left, but you've never had any cohabitation between politicians who are so ideologically opposed to each other as Macron and Le Pen or Bardella would be. And I think if you look at the French constitution, it is very ambivalent and very untested in such a situation, because in previous cohabitations, the fundamental principles that guide French governance, foreign defence policy, European policy, membership of the EU, respect for the European Convention on Human Rights, they were always respected by both the president and the prime minister. If you look at the detail of Le Pen's nationalist programme, and she tries to impose that programme, it would directly conflict with Macron on all of those elements. And, you know, you just have to look at what Le Pen and Bardella were saying through the Euro election campaign, or what they said in the 2022 parliamentary election. They want to withhold France's contribution to the EU budget, the financial contribution France pays into the budget. They want to toughen migration policies in ways that would conflict with the ECHR. They want to subsidise domestic firms that would conflict with the rules of the single market. They don't want to implement the European Union's fiscal rules. And so, you know, the theoretical response to this is the president has responsibility for foreign affairs in Europe and the prime minister domestic policy. That, you know, but what happens where those two bits connect to each other, where there's a relationship between them? And, you know, I know we will talk about Ukraine a bit later, but that's a really important example.
Francoise, what we've seen to an extent in other countries, I'm thinking about Italy primarily, is that you get very kind of militant talk in the elections. And then actually, if the party gets into government, it moderates significantly, particularly on questions to do with the EU. What's your feeling about a Le Pen government in France?
Yeah, I think the comparison with Meloni is actually very good, because if you recall, there were also a lot of media hype and a lot of stories about doomsday scenarios when she became prime minister. And she turned out to be, as you said, quite moderate. And Marine Le Pen even made some approached, she wanted to initiate some kind of rapprochement with her because they belong to a different group in the European Parliament. That didn't go anywhere because I guess Meloni had other concerns. But I think it's a good parallel. Already we've seen with the National Front, the Rassemblement National, that they've had 2 years of working in the opposition in the National Assembly. Well, they've basically been learning the ropes of how to manage that. And there hasn't been any scandals, really. And if they were to be then the first party in some kind of coalition government, it's not really going to be a proper coalition government. But, you know, they would definitely tone down some of their promises or threats that they made during the campaign, because they would have to keep their partners on board if they want to stay in power. So I think it's very likely that in this hypothesis that, you know, they will probably not necessarily try to put in place some of the policies that were mentioned earlier. I mean, they could still try to influence EU policies through the back door, but really, President Macron would still be president for the next 3 years. So really, when it comes to the EU, he will still be the one sitting in the European Council and having a say in directing European legislation, whether it's having to do with migrations or the other things. So, but I think we would see a moderation of their stance.
Mojtaba, one of the things I know which is striking about the difference between Le Pen and Meloni has been their attitudes towards Ukraine. And obviously France's attitude towards Ukraine is absolutely critical. Can you take us through what you think might happen there?
I will. And David, can I make one general point about Meloni and Le Pen and the comparison between them?
Of course.
So I don't buy the comparison, and I think it's a false comparison. And the reason is, Meloni's programme, even in opposition, was never anywhere as extreme as the kind of things Le Pen and Bardella are talking about. And Italy, as a member state of the EU, is much more dependent on the EU than France is. In fact, I would turn the relationship on its head. Europe is much more dependent on France than the other way around. You know, Italy gets hundreds of billions of euros from the EU, and that is so critical to everything Meloni wants to do domestically. She kind of has no choice. I don't think that's the situation with France. You know, if you think about the debate now on Ukraine, the leadership that the European Union is demonstrating on that question is all a consequence of the things Macron is doing and saying, but it ultimately comes down to money. And in order to do meaningful things with money for Ukraine, so Macron has this great initiative, a defense bond at the European level for Ukraine's reconstruction and for the security and defense of the EU, you need parliamentary approval. And so although Macron sits in the European Council, the commitments he makes in that context will ultimately require support in national parliaments. And that's where, if you do have Le Pen, I think, who is a lot more ambivalent about the Ukraine agenda. There's a question about how extreme she would be if she won power and Bardella was prime minister, but is a lot more ambivalent about the commitments that Macron is making via Ukraine. Then the agenda, no matter what Macron says in the European Council, very quickly runs into the sand. The dividing line I would draw is, I think everything France has committed to do for Ukraine domestically would probably remain intact. So the commitments, the financial commitments that have already been passed through Parliament, which Le Pen did not support, that would probably remain intact. But, you know, when you're talking about a coalition of troops, going into the Ukraine theatre? That's something that Macron has been leaning into. Does that still happen if you have a national rally majority in the National Assembly? Can you do anything interesting at the European level on security and defence for Europe? This was about Trump. It was about Russia. This was about long-term European security. That stuff costs money. Many of the officials, I'm in Brussels at the moment, many of the officials I'm talking to here think that entire agenda, which was Macron's in the making, is dead on arrival if Le Pen delivers a majority in the National Assembly in 3 weeks' time.
Mujtaba Rahman there with Francoise Beauchek. My thanks to them and to Hugh Schofield and Sophie Pedder. And my conclusion, well, what a week that first week in July is going to be, both sides of the channel. The Briefing Room will be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight, Caroline Bailey and Miriam Kayum. The editor was Richard Varden and the programme was mixed by Sarah Hockley. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
This is a story about one of Britain's most revered institutions and the theft of ancient treasures that were sold around the world.
It felt like a real punch to the stomach. My God, things are being stolen from our museum.
I'm Katie Razzle, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Thief at the British Museum. At the heart of our tale is an antiquities dealer turned amateur detective thrown into the centre of a global scandal.
I was shocked. I remember that distinctly. My hair stood on end.
Search for Shadow World, Thief at the British Museum, on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.